books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we'll delve into the murky world of romance fraud with author Becky Holmes and our book, Keanu Reeves Is Not In Love With You. Plus, we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library. All that and more on today's Read On. Becky Holmes' Twitter, or X feed, looks at the murky world of online romance fraud. From oil rig workers to soldiers to celebrities such as Keanu Reeves or Brad Pitt, Becky has spent years dealing with these online fraudsters. And now that Twitter feed has become a book, read by Becky herself.
It was while the world was imploding in on itself that I became desperate enough to join the rest of the world online, firstly through dating sites. In the first few months of 2020, I spent hours miserably and pointlessly swiping away at the portal of despair that is Tinder, hopelessly searching for a man to talk to whose profile picture wasn't him holding a dead fish or a selfie in a public toilet mirror with a urinal behind him. I cannot believe how many urinals I saw within the first few days. A quick word to the men listening to this who are currently looking for love online. No one wants to see a massive smelly trout or a massive smelly trough. Having exhausted the profiles of all Tinder males within a 50-mile radius and resisted the temptation to widen my search to men aged anywhere between 18 and 80 worldwide, I thought, sod it, I'm joining Twitter. That will surely banish all feelings of isolation and depression, and I'll immediately find my people. I'll make tons of online friends, and I'll never feel lonely or depressed again. I've been asked many times why I chose @deathtospinach as my Twitter handle, and this seems as good a time as any to reveal the reason. The truth is, here we go, buckle up. I don't like spinach. A miserable vegetable with the texture of filamentous algae and the taste of rotten anuses, but I assume. If I had thought for a moment that I'd grow a decent Twitter following and end up writing a book because of it, I might well have chosen a more relevant handle. But as it is, I'm now stuck with this and am regularly referred to as the Spinach Woman. As a spinach hater, it has rather backfired to forevermore be named after it, rather like someone with arachnophobia being called Terrifyingly Massive Spider Woman.
A clip of Becky Holmes reading from her book, Keanu Reeves Is Not In Love With You. And Becky joins us now. Now, Becky, tell us about your celebrity boyfriends.
I have many, many celebrity boyfriends. Keanu Reeves, Brad Pitt, Liam Neeson, Jason Statham, Prince William, Prince Andrew, which was slightly awkward at the time. I have a plethora of celebrity boyfriends, Robert.
And it's not just celebrities. You've got a gaggle of soldiers and pilots and oil rig workers as well. Now, how do you attract these guys?
Well, they come through to you when you're on social media. If you don't have your security settings very high, then they start to approach you through whether it's Twitter or Instagram or dating sites, of course. And most people will block and delete them, but I like to sort of play along and waste a bit of their time. Now, that's great fun for me. The problem is that as soon as you engage with one of these people, your details are sold onto what they call a suckers list, which means that you are then kind of fair game for anybody who's bought this list, and you end up with absolutely tons of them.
And you've been posting these up on your Twitter feed @deathtospinach, which I've been following for a while. What have you got against spinach?
Oh, do you know... I can't tell you how disgusting I think it is. And the problem is I'm vegan. So actually, spinach should be an amazing source of nutrients for me, but I can't even look at the stuff. So when I obviously joined Twitter, I had no idea that it would turn into this and I'd end up doing a book and forever be known as the spinach woman. It wasn't in my plan for life, I have to say.
As I said, the Twitter feed became a book. How did the author Kimberly Chambers get involved in that process?
Oh, so when I started posting these up on Twitter and my following started to grow, and I noticed that Kimberly Chambers followed me, and I love her books. I become completely obsessed every time she brings a new one out, and she's about to as well. So I'm really excited. And I messaged her through Twitter and I said, oh my God, I love your stuff. I'm so pleased that you're following me. And she said to me, oh no, I think your stuff is hilarious. I'm going to tell my agent about you. So once that process started and I'd been talking to the agency for a little while, we then agreed that I'll put a book proposal together. And then it's just spiraled from there.
And you went with Unbound. How long did it take to get funded on there?
It very much depends on the number of people who come forward to pledge for the books. Now, I was very, very lucky. So I think Unbound tend to sort of say, you know, you should be fully funded within a year. I was very lucky in that mine was funded in about 3 weeks. because when you've got a quite a large social media following, if people have been following you for a while and they like the things you do, I think it's much easier to ask people to pledge and kind of effectively pre-order their book, even though they know they're going to be waiting a long time for it. So I cannot tell you. I mean, I said this to somebody earlier, that when I hear people on TV or radio say, oh, I'm so grateful for everyone's support, I used to think, oh yeah, whatever. But actually, having had the support of so many people, it's just been brilliant, and it wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Now, the book came out a couple of weeks ago and there is an audio version as well that you recorded. We'll talk about that now in a minute. But as funny as it is to see about Liam Neeson asking you for money for his latest film, there is a really serious side to this, because romance, fraud and scams like this are far more common than we think.
They are. I think it's probably one of the most underreported crimes that there is. There's this real stigma around being a victim of romance fraud, because people, they really believe the stereotype that in order to be a victim of romance fraud, you have to be a middle-aged woman who's lonely and desperate for a man. And in actual fact, it's simply not the case. The people that I interviewed for the book, they were clever, charming, articulate, you know, a good circle of friends. This stereotype, we need to get rid of that, because then I think more people will start to come forward and to report what's happened to them.
Yeah, my mum was scammed. It wasn't a romance scam, but it was the same sort of thing. It was an authorised push payment fraud.
Yeah.
And she was embarrassed about it, and she said she fell for it. And you've got a problem with those words, fell for it, yeah.
I do. And I talk about this quite a lot. The words fall for, it's something that we use only when it comes to fraud. So, you know, you wouldn't get home and say, oh my goodness, I've just fell for a mugging. It wouldn't happen. You wouldn't say, oh, I've fallen for domestic abuse. It's not something that people ever use other than for fraud or scams. And I think it belittles the crime, because essentially what it's saying is that it's something you walked into. And that's not how it is. Romance fraud is a crime that happens to you, just like any other crime.
Yeah, I went on a bit of a deep dive researching this, and I ended up reading scripts that they give out to people. And it's very detailed. It's like, well, why can't you call me on your mobile? Sorry, we can't use mobile phones here because the Taliban use them to detonate
bombs.
And, yeah. You know, it's so detailed and goes a lot deeper than you think.
It does. And one of the reasons that romance fraudsters use particular jobs, so in the army, a doctor working in a war-torn country, somebody on an oil rig, for example, it's for the very reason that you've just said, which is that they've got a really good excuse to say, no, I can't ring you, or no, I can't speak to you on video, or more importantly, I can't access my money. So, you know, you're absolutely right to pick up on that point.
Is there a difference between people scamming women and scamming men?
Yeah, there is. And It's a stereotype, but unfortunately, I think it's true in the world of romance fraud. So it tends to be, and I'm not saying 100% by any means, but the pattern tends to be that women are wooed by the promise of love and romance, and men are wooed by the promise of some kind of sexual gratification. Now, the problem with that is that often that ends up in sextortion, which is when somebody is blackmailing someone over intimate images that they've received. So, although initially it might seem quite different, ultimately it's all about getting money out of the victim.
One September evening, I was contacted by Handsome Raymond. I'd like to take some credit for this next paragraph, please, because I'm saying it exactly how it was written, and I've entered into a not considerable number of altercations with autocorrect when I was writing it. Raymond wrote, "How are you doing today? Hope you stay safe as well. I am delighted to have you here on my Twitter. I am glad to browse through your profile and as well watch your pictures. I must confess that you physically represent what I seek in my ideal woman. Your looks got me impressed. Sincerely, I like you, and I would wish to exchange further correspondence with you. I will be glad if you give me the privilege to know more about your person. Let's write and get acquainted with each other. Maybe we could be best of friend. My name is Raymond. I'm from United States of America widowed." On this occasion, I must have been phenomenally bored and or livid about something because I didn't immediately delete the message. After all, it was so beautifully written. I replied to him and feigned interest in getting to know him, but threw in a few curveballs to see how many of my answers he was actually reading. I told him I had no skin, I regularly holiday on Jupiter, my best friend is a kangaroo, and that I have more aubergines than Judi Dench. It became evident that Raymond wasn't paying me the level of attention that I require from a partner, but that I could have enormous fun and relieve some of the crushing lockdown boredom. Over the couple of weeks that Raymond and I conversed, I began screenshotting the messages and putting them up on Twitter, and the people who followed me seemed to find it as entertaining as I did.
Another clip of my guest Becky Holmes reading Keanu Reeves Is Not In Love With You. How was it recording the audio version of the book?
It was really weird. It was really weird. I was sitting in this little pod. There was all foam all over the walls, and it was just me and a tablet and a microphone. And it felt really, really strange. And it felt odd to be reading my own book. And when you're talking into a microphone and you've got headphones on, you hear your own voice in a much different way to how you hear it in your own head. So it was like I was speaking the words, but I was listening to somebody else saying it back. But on the plus side, when I'd finished reading it out, I actually thought to myself, oh, that was quite good.
I'm sure there's something about this, but there is a little dopamine hit, I think, when you finish an audiobook. I've seen narrators come out on quite a little high. Did you resist the urge to edit it as you went along?
Yes, I did. I mean, it was a little bit difficult in places because my book has quite a few photographs in it. So nothing that I couldn't describe. It was quite easy, but it was, I guess, sort of wondering how much detail to go into. But once I'd got into the swing of it, it was okay.
I can imagine some of the photos you had to describe.
Yes, indeed.
talking of which, can you give us a little audio description of the cover?
So the cover is, coincidentally, my two favourite colours. So it's a very bright yellow background with Keanu Reeves Is Not In Love With You in a very bright magenta, I guess it is. There's a photograph of Keanu Reeves's face and the eyes are cut out, so it looks like a mask. And then it's got the murky world of online romance fraud and my name. And it's got three very short quotes from people that we asked to read the book and to review it. So it's got "Eye Opening" by Jane Fallon, "Fabulous" by Jeremy Vine, and "Extremely Funny" by Peter James.
Now, it is a funny way of talking about something really serious. Was that your intention?
Yeah, definitely. So before I even started the book, I guess my reputation on Twitter was as somebody who makes fun of things. Not the victims, I might add, but sort of makes fun of the fraudsters and wastes their time. And I became very aware that when we speak to people about fraud, it's often incredibly boring and people switch off almost immediately. So what I wanted to do was write something that people would enjoy reading or enjoy listening to, and they'd become interested in the subject, I guess almost like as an unintended consequence. So the book starts off quite humorous. It includes a lot of my tweets. But as it goes on, it becomes much darker, I suppose, in its content when it starts to really look at this horrible underworld. But what I hope I've done is still maintain some of the humour in the way that I've used the language, because I just wanted to bring something that's normally quite boring into, I guess, the mainstream.
Yeah, that's one thing I had to talk to my mum about. Look, one of the people who was caught in this authorised push payment fraud was somebody who ran a cybersecurity firm. So anyone can get caught.
Oh, absolutely. One of the people that I interviewed for the book was actually a UK detective, and she was defrauded. So, and again, it comes back to this stereotype of, you know, it's a particular type of person that becomes defrauded. And it really isn't. It is anybody. And I wrote an article for The Guardian recently, and one of the things that I said in there was that a real pool of victims are the people who go around saying, well, of course, you know, they'd never get me. I'm too clever for that. Because when that's the case, people often take their eye off the ball. And sometimes it's those people who actually get caught.
If someone's listening and thinks they may be involved in something like this, what would your advice to them be?
Well, if they suspect that they are involved with this, then it's, you know, I think there's something to be said for trusting your instincts on that. There are a number of things that you can do. So I always urge people to do a reverse image search. Now, this will tell you whether the person whose photograph is being used on their profile is actually who they say they are. And it's something that fraudsters do a lot. They take other people's photographs from Instagram accounts, Facebook, you know, wherever they can. So that's one thing. Something which people are very, very reluctant to do, but is so important, is to talk to family and friends. And this isn't just when you're starting online dating. This is when you're talking to somebody for the first time on social media, because we all want to be loved. That's human nature. And it does mean that sometimes our judgment is clouded. Well, often our judgment is clouded. And it really takes somebody with an external perspective to be able to perhaps talk things through with you a bit more. So I would definitely, if you're in any doubt, definitely speak to somebody else.
Now the book's out in the world, has the real Keanu Reeves been in touch?
Well, I wouldn't know, because I'd assume he was a scammer. do you know, my agent has actually sent a copy to his agent. I doubt we'll hear anything, but wouldn't that just be absolutely glorious if we did? The book's actually going to be released in the States in April. So I'm hanging on to the idea that Keanu will be walking down a street and he'll see it in a bookshop window. I would absolutely love that.
While I was having colossal fun causing the fake pilot Mark Patrick considerable panic, I was simultaneously doing some poking around online. I learned that the person behind this Twitter account was using the identity of a real pilot. At this point, I was still quite green when it came to social media, and it hadn't really occurred to me that identity theft would be quite so prolific and so blatant. That naivety didn't last long. Not only is the chap in the photo, real name Patrick Biedenkap, a real pilot, he is also a rather well-known one. He has an extremely snazzy website, a popular YouTube channel, over 200,000 followers on Facebook, and get this, he has nearly 800,000 Instagram followers. which is 799,850, more than the average user. However, what the real pilot Patrick doesn't have is a Twitter account. Oh, and what's another thing the real pilot Patrick doesn't have? Any interest in women. I only know these things about the impossibly handsome Patrick Biedenkap because I'd heard of him. One of my closest friends is both gay and an aviation nerd, so you can imagine the kind of conversations we've had about this flying Adonis. But if you didn't know these things, would you automatically think fraud? Most of us on Twitter are followed by people we don't know in real life. On the whole, this is great. We get to chat to new people from all over the world. However, it also sadly opens you up to the dark side of social media, which is, quite frankly, stuffed full of complete... something that I hoped my Twitter account was highlighting.
Keanu Reeves Is Not In Love With You is out now in print, as an ebook, and in audio, as read by Becky Holmes. And Becky, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
And Becky will be back at the end of today's show with the books of her life. But now, talking of books, let's take our first visit to the RNIB Talking Books Library.
The first new book in the library this week is Miss Benson's Beetle by Rachel Joyce. It was donated by Penguin Random House.
When Marjorie was 10, she fell in love with a beetle. It was a bright summer's day, and all the windows of the rectory were open. She had an idea about sailing her wooden animals across the floor, two by two, but the set had belonged to her brothers once, and most of them were either coloured in or broken. Some were even missing altogether. She was wondering if, in the circumstances, you could pair a three-legged camel and a bird with spots, when her father came out of his study. "Do you have a moment, old girl?" he said. "There's something I want to show you." She put down the camel and the bird, and she followed him. She would have stood on her head if he'd asked. Her father went to his desk. He sat there, nodding and smiling. She could tell he didn't have a proper reason for calling her. He just wanted her to be with him for a while. Since her four brothers had left for war, he often called her. Or she'd find him loitering at the foot of the stairs, searching for something without seeming to know what it was. His eyes were the kindest in the world, and the bald top of his head gave him a naked look like an egg. "I think I have something that might interest you, old girl," he said. "Nothing much, but maybe you'll like it."
It is 1950. In a devastating moment of clarity, Marjorie Benson abandons her dead-end job and advertises for an assistant to accompany her on an expedition. She's going to travel to the other side of the world to search for a beetle that may or may not exist. Enid Pretty, in her unlikely pink travel suit, is not the companion Marjorie had in mind, and yet together they will be drawn into an adventure that will exceed every expectation. They will risk everything, break all the rules, and at the top of a red mountain, discover their best selves.
At this point, he would normally produce something he'd found in the garden, but instead, he opened a book called Incredible Creatures. It looked important, like the Bible or an encyclopedia, and there was a general smell of old things, but that could well have been him. Marjorie stood at his side, trying hard not to fidget. The first page was a painted illustration of a man. He had a normal face and normal arms, but where his legs should have been, a green mermaid tail. She was amazed. The next picture was just as strange, a squirrel, like one in the garden, but this had wings. And it went on, page after page, one incredible creature after another. "Well, well, look," her father kept saying. "Well, now, goodness me, look at this chap, Marjorie."
"Are they real?"
"They might be."
"Are they in a zoo?"
"Oh, no, dear heart. If these creatures live, they've not been found. There are people who believe they exist, but they haven't caught them yet, so they can't prove it." She had no idea what he was talking about. Until that moment, she'd assumed everything in the world was already found. It had never occurred to her things might happen in reverse, that you could see a picture of something in a book, that you could as good as imagine it, and then go off and look.
Miss Benson's Beetle by Rachel Joyce is narrated by Juliet Stevenson and runs for 12 hours, 5 minutes.
Martina Cole is a reader favourite for those who like their thrillers gritty. Her latest is The Graft, and it was given to us by Headline.
Tammy was finally asleep. The paramedics had seen to that, and the boys were with their nanny in the playroom. Nick could feel the silence hanging over the house, and he hated it. Dawn had come and gone, and somehow the day had passed. The police had talked to him over and over, until eventually his doctor had told them he needed breathing space. He was, after all, in shock. Not that the police had taken that into consideration, of course. But once they had ascertained the intruder's identity, they seemed to go easier with Nick somehow, were softer, more inclined to believe in his fear for his family. He had worried for a while that they would see him as the villain of the story and not the boy who'd been burgling his house. The world had gone mad that way lately.
Looking back, Nick Leary couldn't say exactly what kept him awake that night. He'd had a lot on his mind. Perhaps he'd been thinking about the respectable Essex business that he ran, or about his two young sons sleeping in the room next door, or was it simply the sound of his beautiful wife's steady breathing beside him? Whatever it was, he was awake when he heard someone's footsteps downstairs, and Nick's instinct was to fight. It had always been that way, to protect the things he treasured most. His family, his privacy, his reputation. He'd grafted for things all his life, and no one was going to jeopardise him now. Unless, of course, Nick's instinct is wrong, and what happens this time is the start of something even he cannot stop.
His mother Angela watched the changing expressions on her son's face and said stoutly, "You'll be all right, Nick. No one in their right mind would give you a capture for this, son. You was defending your own." His mother's voice was harsh, its cockney twang seeming out of place in these palatial surroundings. She'd slept through it all thanks to her penchant for a bedtime whiskey. "Let it go, mummy. Make a nice cuppa." She plugged in the kettle, but he could see the anger in her stiff shoulders and the set of her back. He smiled gently then. She was game, his mother. A right little firebrand. He adored her with all his being. But her mouth had often got her into trouble, not just with her family, but with others who came into her orbit. Angela Leary never knew when to leave well alone. Her voice rose with her anger and her animosity at what had occurred. To enter her son's home armed. It was the gun that frightened her most, that and the fact the boy turned out to have been a known drug user and all-round thief. When the paramedic had removed his balaclava, the investigating officers had instantly identified him. In fact, he was well known to all the police roundabout.
The Graft by Martina Cole is narrated by Annie Adlington and runs for 12 hours, 38 minutes.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, I'm John Cormack, and I've been reading these books. Crikey, when I think about it, 18, 19 years now. Seems like a lifetime, man and boy. I suppose favourite books, well, Roddy Doyle comes springs to mind, all the Roddy Doyle, the Barry Town trilogy, which leap off the page and are wonderful to read. But I think one that would even surpass that is a book called The Butcher Boy by Patrick McCabe. That was his first novel, and shocked and, I must say, frightened the life out of me, and it was splendid to read.
When I was a young lad, 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, I lived in a small town where they were all after me on account of what I had done on Mrs. Nugent. I was hiding out by the river in a hole under a tangle of briars. It was a hide me and Joe made. "Death to all dogs who enter here," we said. Except us, of course. You could see plenty from the inside, but no one could see you. Weeds and driftwood and everything floated downstream under the dark archway of the bridge. Sailing away to Timbuktu. Good luck now, weeds, I said. And then I stuck me nose out to see what was going on. Plink. Rain, if you don't mind. But I wasn't complaining. I liked rain. The hiss of the water and the earth so soft bright green plants would nearly sprout beside you. This is the life, I said. I sat there staring at a water drop on the end of a leaf. It couldn't make up its mind whether it wanted to fall or not. It didn't matter. I was in no hurry. Take your time, drop, I said. We've got all the time we want now. We've got all the time in the world.
I think it's a great service, the RNIB Talking Books. And it's also quite personal for me because my mother lost her sight in the 5 years before she died and used to get the books, which was lovely and a great comfort to her. The only slight downside with that was that she used to get my books. And I used to get notes on the phone. As in, I don't like the way you did that.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Still to come on today's show, Becky Holmes recommends some favourites in books of your life. But for now, let's travel back in time and hear about a great royal rivalry. In 16th century Europe, two women came to hold all the power, against all the odds. One, a virgin queen who ruled her kingdom alone, the other a clandestine leader who used her children to shape the dynasties of Europe. They were Elizabeth I and Catherine de Medici. Their story is told in Blood, Fire and Gold by Estelle Peronc. Narrators by Anna Wilson-Jones.
She had been waiting for this moment for a long time, and now, finally, it had arrived. Holding her head up high, she took a deep breath, ready to meet her fate. It was a warm Thursday afternoon, and Lady Anne Boleyn was about to leave Greenwich Palace in a brightly painted brigantine. Surrounded by her ladies-in-waiting and accompanied by around 100 similar vessels, all garnished with banners and standards, Anne had never felt nor looked more resplendent in her life.
I'm Estelle Peronc and I'm the author of Blood, Fire and Gold. And it's the story of the rivalry and the friendship and the complex relationship between Elizabeth I of England and Catherine de' Medici. It's a story of blood and of fire and of gold. And what I mean by that is that of war, but also of glory and of real difficulties that they had to face. And you will be like taking into the relationship which, in my opinion, mattered the most between these two women in order to understand 16th century England, 16th century France, but also 16th century Scotland.
It seems like you've fallen in love with these two women.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, it's about their strength and their weakness. It's about the women they were, so the women behind the queens. Actually, in my book, in the epilogue, it's called like Queen of Hearts and Queen of Spades, and I'm taking you through my own thoughts about these two women as who they were and what they meant for me.
In this country, we think more of the relationship between Elizabeth and Mary, Queen of Scots.
I would say that the relationship with Catherine was much more complicated and more complex, and I would say that actually Mary, Queen of Scots is also a big part of this book because she played a massive role in that relationship. She played a massive role in how the relationship is going to develop.
As she looked out at the city around her, the sounds of drums, trumpets and flutes rang out over the River Thames. As the procession drew closer to the Tower of London, a cannon fired a salute, while behind the official vessels, more than 200 small boats welcomed her.
Now, the audio version of Blood, Fire and Gold is narrated by Anna Wilson-Jones. Did you have a choice in the narrator?
Yes, I did, and I absolutely love who I chose. She did a great job, and I'm so glad she accepted my when I asked her to do it for me. So.
Do you not fancy doing it yourself?
No. Mostly because of my accent. I think that it could put people off. But also, I like the fact that I had a choice of different actresses to read the book, and I chose the best one for it. She did an amazing job.
Anne stared at the beautiful sight, full of awe. The Thames was flooded with boats, and the air filled with joyful clamour. And as the future Queen of England arrived at the city to be crowned at last, the din increased. Despite her enemies claiming she had been rejected by the people, their presence as Anne arrived in the city proved the contrary. She did have support among the Londoners, for now at least.
Blood, Fire and Gold, the story of Elizabeth I and Catherine de' Medici by Estelle Farrunk, is available commercially and also available in the RNIB Talking Books Library, where it's recently been joined by...
Another reader favourite is Katie Flynn. Forgotten Dreams has just been added to the library.
It was a hot afternoon in August, and Lottie Lacey was sitting on the top step of No. 2 Victoria Court, staring unseeingly ahead of her whilst her tongue checked her small pearly teeth, as it had done so often this past week. Of course, the result was always the same. She had a wobbler. Several of her friends had already lost some baby teeth, which was not unusual at 7 years old, but they could regard such a loss with equanimity. Some even put the tooth under their pillow and next day found it gone and a round brown penny in its place. But even if their parents could not afford to hand out pennies whenever a tooth came out, there would be no dire consequences for the tooth losers. Lottie, however, knew her own case to be very different, for her mother had impressed upon her the importance of looking sweet. It was one of the first prerequisites for a child star, a subject on which Mammy had been very bitter recently. For while Lottie had been in hospital, she'd been forced to employ another little girl to appear nightly in the current production at the Gaiety Theatre just off the Scotland Road. But Merle sang flat and could not be persuaded to mime her songs, so she'd been told to go. Consequently, Mammy had had to do a solo act until Lottie had been well enough to perform once more.
Lottie and her mother Luella share a house in Victoria Court with Mr. Magic and his son Baz. Lottie is a child star dancing and singing at the Gaiety Theatre to an enraptured audience. Luella acts as Max Magic's assistant. But a road accident causes Lottie to lose her memory. Luella tries to help, but the white mist remains. Then Lottie meets a boy with golden brown eyes who calls her sassy and accuses her of running away. It is after this meeting that the dreams start, dreams of another life, almost another world, and Lottie, sharing them with Baz, begins to believe he knows more than he chooses to tell.
Sweetness, however, was not merely a matter of small, pearly teeth. It encompassed hair as well. Lottie's hair was brown and straight, but her mammy had decided that it simply would not do.
"You see, Queen, when you're part of a double act, a mother and daughter act like you and me, then it's best to look alike," she'd said, giving her appealing smile and twisting a strand of Lottie's hair into a ringlet. "So, this very evening, I'll lighten your hair up a bit. It won't take more than an hour, and I'll buy a comic paper so that you've got something to read while the peroxide works." She'd smiled lovingly at her daughter. "Then you'll be as fair as me, and the audience won't ever know that we aren't both true blondes." That had been when Lottie was only six. But even at six, she'd been well aware that Mammy was no more a true blonde than herself. She had not been tempted to comment, however, for Mammy could be reduced to tears or temper when unpalatable facts were pointed out. So Lottie had submitted to a long evening of boredom and discomfort, whilst her mother covered her hair in a thick white paste, then rinsed and shampooed, and finally rubbed her head briskly before settling her on the hearthrug before the fire to dry out. Later, Lottie had looked in the mirror and had been shocked to find her hair not merely lighter, but as yellow as her mother's. She'd hated it at first, but soon grew accustomed, though it was a nuisance having to have her roots done every few weeks. "Stage lighting is strong, and it wouldn't do for you to come on half brown and half blonde," her mother had explained. But like most theatricals, I am a perfectionist. So even though it's a bother, I shall make sure you always look your best, as I do myself.
Forgotten Dreams by Katie Flynn is read by Anne Dover and runs for 13 hours and 4 minutes.
For those in the mood for something more thrilling, we have The House in Rye Lane by Susan Allott, which was donated by HarperCollins.
It was the day of the murder, a dark Wednesday in South London, and Diana was listening to the lodgers. They were on the staircase, all three of them. She couldn't see them from the ground floor, but she heard them clearly. She felt their shock. Lee Delaney was shouting orders at his wife and child. There was fear in his voice, in the quiet of the house. One of them whimpered and puked on the carpet. "Do you hear me?" Lee said. Ruth and Cookie replied that they did. He ran up to the next floor, told them not to move. Diana listened. She located the mother and son from their voices. They were together on the stairs, halfway up. Out on the street, she heard rain bouncing off the tarmac, a car horn on the far side of the Rye. A door slammed at the top of the house. Cookie spoke, frightened words that Diana didn't catch. But she knew his voice with its adolescent tremor. She pictured him, stooped and awkward in his school uniform, all at odds with himself. "That strange boy." "Let me think," Ruth said to her son. "Be quiet a minute."
2008. The house Maxine and Seb have just bought was a bargain, a huge Georgian townhouse on the edge of Peckham Rye. It needs a lot of work, but Max couldn't resist it. Now they are in, though, nothing seems to be going right, and as the problems mount up, Max starts to doubt her relationship as well as her decision. Is Seb all he seems to be? And why are the neighbours so evasive about the house's previous owner? 1994. Cookie and his parents have been forced by his dad's gambling debts to move into the attic room of a big old house as lodgers. Tensions run high between them and their elderly landlady, and there's something odd about the place that Cookie can't quite put his finger on. 1843. Horatio built this house for his beloved wife, who then died in mysterious circumstances. After a second death on the premises, both his servants and the locals are starting to talk. Horatio's grief is tinged with shame and guilt. What is he hiding? And will the house ever be free of his legacy?
Diana wished she had never let them into her house. This family with all their problems. But you couldn't pick and choose lodgers in this part of town. And the house put most normal people off. She had lived here all her life, as had all the Lloyds before her, not because it was a beloved family home, but because no one had ever managed to sell it. It had been grand once, apparently. But nothing had ever gone right in the house on Rye Lane. It was a house of mistakes, of luck turned bad, of love gone cold. Most people knew that before they got through the door. Ruth stepped down into the hallway. Diana heard her shoes on the tiles, the skim of her shower-proof coat. Ruth despised her. Diana had cottoned on to this too late. She'd thought Ruth was reserved, a bit surly. But it ran deeper than that, and stronger, more poisonous for being suppressed. It had scared her when it rose to the surface. "Don't look down," Ruth said to Cookie as he followed her. But Cookie looked. His face was the last face Diana would see. His pale fright at the sight of her.
The House on Rye Lane by Susan Allott is read by Tom Babbage, Tim Bruce and Coral Sinclair and runs for 8 hours 58 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. The Second World War caused a metal shortage, which had an unexpected effect for Talking Books listeners.
And the American Foundation for the Blind sent us a gift of 500,000 gramophone needles. And of course, needles became blunt. If you don't have needles to play these gramophone records, you just couldn't hear them, basically. So the blunter the needles became, the worse the sound became. So we needed new needles to keep the thing going.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums, and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Allison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
Wednesdays at 8 p.m, Thursday at noon, and Sundays at 11 a.m.
The Moth on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's show, let's return to Becky Holmes for the books of her life. A book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
When I was very, very tiny, my dad used to read the Mr. Men books to me, and I knew them all off by heart. And I remember him telling me that I was very, very small, and I toddled into their room, toddled around to his side of the bed, and said, "Daddy, how do you read?" And I think I have been, from the day that I learnt to read, I have been obsessed with it. And I think my favourite childhood book, I've thought about this a lot recently, it's got to be The BFG by Roald Dahl. That brought me hours and hours of joy.
The moonbeam was brighter than ever on Sophie's pillow. She decided to get out of bed and close the gap in the curtains. You got punished if you were caught out of bed after lights out. Even if you said you had to go to the lavatory, that was not accepted as an excuse, and they punished you just the same. But there was no one about now. Sophie was sure of that. She reached out for her glasses that lay on the chair beside her bed. They had steel rims and very thick lenses, and she could hardly see a thing without them. She put them on, then she slipped out of bed and tiptoed over to the window. When she reached the curtains, Sophie hesitated. She longed to duck underneath them and lean out of the window to see what the world looked like now that the witching hour was at hand. She listened again. Everywhere, it was deathly still. The longing to look out became so strong she couldn't resist it. Quickly, she ducked under the curtains and leant out of the window. In the silvery moonlight, the village street she knew so well seemed completely different. The houses looked bent and crooked, like houses in a fairy tale. Everything was pale and ghostly and milky white. Across the road, she could see Mrs. Rance's shop, where you bought buttons and wool and bits of elastic. It didn't look real. There was something dim and misty about that too. Sophie allowed her eye to travel further and further down the street. Suddenly, she froze. There was something coming up the street on the opposite side. It was something black. Something tall and black. Something very tall and very black and very thin.
The BFG by Roald Dahl is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Gretel Davis. is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
My go-to book for those kinds of days, not that I've had too many recently, is Lord of the Flies. It's not a cozy book, I would say. It gets quite unpleasant. But we read it when I was in school, and my English teacher is somebody who really, really inspired me. And whenever I read it, I think back to those days.
The boy with fair hair lowered himself down the last few feet of rock and began to pick his way towards the lagoon. Though he'd taken off his school sweater and trailed it now from one hand, his grey shirt stuck to him and his hair was plastered to his forehead. All round him, the long scar smashed into the jungle was a bath of heat. He was clambering heavily among the creepers and broken trunks when a bird, a vision of red and yellow, flashed upwards with a witch-like cry. And this cry was echoed by another.
"Hi," it said. "Wait a minute."
The undergrowth at the side of the scar was shaken, and a multitude of raindrops fell pattering.
"Wait a minute," the voice said. "I got caught up."
The fair boy stopped and jerked his stockings with an automatic gesture that made the jungle seem for a moment like the home counties. The voice spoke again.
"I can't hardly move with all these creeper things."
The owner of the voice came backing out of the undergrowth so that twigs scratched on a greasy windbreaker. The naked crooks of his knees were plump, caught and scratched by thorns. He bent down, removed the thorns carefully, and turned round. He was shorter than the fair boy and very fat. He came forward, searching out safe lodgements for his feet, and then looked up through thick spectacles.
"Where's the man with the megaphone?"
The fair boy shook his head.
"This is an island. At least I think it's an island. That's a reef out in the sea. Perhaps there aren't any grown-ups anywhere."
The fat boy looked startled.
"There was that pilot, but he wasn't in the passenger tube. He was up in the cabin in front."
The fair boy was peering at the reef through screwed-up eyes.
"All them other kids," the fat boy went on. "Some of them must have got out." "They must have, mustn't they?"
Lord of the Flies by William Golding is available from RNIB Talking Books as read by Peter Wickham. And is there a book you've read recently? Doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently is fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
Yes, I would wholeheartedly recommend a book. It's called When the Dust Settles, and it's by Lucy Easthope. And this is a fascinating woman. She's an expert on recovering from disaster. So if something really awful happens in the world, so tsunami, the 7/7 bombings, the Grenfell Tower, the Ukraine war, it's her that's kind of drafted in to talk about how to best deal with these things. It is fascinating. I only finished it about 3 days ago, and I'm already thinking, when can I actually start that again?
Disaster is formed from the Latin dis and astro, meaning bad stars. It refers to an ancient belief that when the stars are in a bad position, unfortunate events are going to occur. A misaligning of the astronomical bodies sends the world off kilter. On an individual level, a disaster might be losing our job, our relationship, or just our keys. But an official disaster, a major incident, as English planners are now told to call it, is something at quite a different scale. Something that most of us don't expect or anticipate. We don't think about disasters until they are on the news, after they happen. But I cannot imagine living my life like that. I've always found myself analysing what might happen and why. Since I was a child, I've always tried to be the first to know about the perils all around and ahead of us. When we were learning about the Great War, I wanted to linger on the pandemic of 1918 straight after it. When we learned about Florence Nightingale, I wanted to know more about the Crimean War, less about the lamp. I was fascinated by stories of Typhoid Mary, the ultimate super spreader, and the way that she spread her pestilence around hundreds of households in New York. The second that I hear about a new potential disaster risk, I start weighing up its impact, the immediate consequences and effects on those around its epicentre. During my student years, I began to find others who thought the same way. In their case, though, it wasn't an innate fascination that drew them to disaster. On the contrary, this was a club nobody wanted to be in. They were the survivors and families of the many mass fatality incidents that had punctuated the 80s and 90s in the UK, and they had formed themselves into a support and advocacy group, Disaster Action. I found them without knowing to look for them. In 1999, Dr. Anne Eyre was a young academic who had dedicated the first decade of her working life to improving the care of people after disasters. As a 21-year-old PhD student, she had been trapped in the Leppings Lane crush at Hillsborough. Anne was the first ever person that I sent an email to, using the first ever email account that I was given. Gingerly putting my brand new knowledge of search engines to use, I'd found her name and email address at the top of an article about survivors' proactive responses to disaster. I asked her if there were ways I could help with her work, and Anne generously and effusively replied with an invitation to a conference.
When the dust settles, stories of love, loss and hope from an expert in disaster by Lucy Easthope is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library as read by the author. And once again, Becky Holmes, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.